What's up, everybody? Welcome to the Two Woke Nerds podcast. I am your host, Raymond Summerlin, and I'm joined, as I am every week, by my very good friend, my very own chocolate bear, Mr. Gerald Ulysses Goodrich.
Ulysses?
I'm just giving you a middle name.
I like it. That's fine. As is indicated by my Twitter handle, it is G.U. Goodridge is my Twitter handle. So that is perfect. I think that's fantastic. Ulysses is such an awesome name. Like,
yeah, Percival Ulysses Cox.
Yep.
Ron Ulysses Swanson.
Dude, I don't know who. I mean, who else could there
all
be?
All the men I respect in my life have Ulysses as their middle name. That's why I want it to be yours.
I feel like I want to rock some mutton chops now. Like, that's where life needs to go. It reminds me a little bit of the episode of Scrubs with the mutton chops. I feel like that's exactly where my mind goes. Like, it's all I can think about. That and Andrew Luck's mid-season neck beard. There's the two things I think about when I hear the name Ulysses.
You can't make me say this. Which is the greatest moment from the Mutton Chops episode.
Yes.
When he just leads them on a rant. It's fantastic.
Okay. This isn't a Scrubs episode though. Not a Scrubs episode.
Who cares? We talk about Scrubs whenever we want to. I am going to do up the paperwork for you to change your middle name to Ulysses. I actually don't know what your middle name is.
Holman.
I really didn't know that at all.
Yeah.
Do you know my middle name?
Michael.
Oh, that's a good pull. That was a good pull. That's a good pull right there.
Nice.
Good
job.
Friend bonding that's happening via podcast.
Yeah, people are learning so much about us. Let's go and give out our socials and our mother's maiden names over here.
Speaking of friend bonding, look at that segue. We're going to be talking today about the Netflix, I think I can call it a super show at this point, phenomenon known as Stranger Things, which I finished, I guess, about a week and a half ago, and I think you finished over the weekend, maybe, and it's just, I think we both have similar opinions on the show, and so I'm interested to dive into it and see kind of where it goes, and also talk about a tinfoil theory, which I think listeners of this show know I enjoy quite a lot, especially the Merman Varys. So it's going to be a lot of fun for us to get into that. Before we do that, we'll hit up some news, as we always do. The first piece of news is there was a new trailer that came out for a movie called The Arrival, starring Amy Adams and Jeremy Renner, about as the title suggests, an arrival of aliens. So what did you think about the trailer?
I liked it. I think I liked it more than you did, Ray, clearly, as our pre-show conversation led us to, but I'm intrigued by this film. I think the concept of like first contact is really, really interesting to me. And something that I really, really think is going to be cool about this film is, and maybe this is just my own like personal tinfoil hat, but I really think the language barrier is going to be something that complicates first contact that will never actually happen in real life. But if first contact actually did happen, like language and communication, like there's a line in the trailer, it's like they need to know the difference between guns and tools, and then someone says, well, a lot of times they're the same thing. And so those little like linguistic differences that even get in the middle of our own current interpersonal relations with people, I think, are going to be interesting about this film. I mean, we think we just saw kind of the biggest uniting of countries and cultures from across the world in the Olympics just ended as this time of recording. And I think it's just interesting to see sci-fi holding up a mirror to things that happen in real life. Because I think language and communication is something that really is a struggle for a lot of people nowadays. I mean, we see a lot of xenophobia coming up in the current election, and we see a lot of those types of things happening. So I'm really intrigued to see that. Amy Adams is kind of hit or miss with me. I think she's done a lot of good things, and she's done a lot of really, really terrible things. Really, most of the cast in this film is kind of hit or miss. I mean, Renner has two Academy Award nominations, but he also has a couple of Razzie nominations. The same goes for Forrest Whitaker. So I think that's going to be an interesting thing to see. Is it going to be one of their good movies, or is it going to be one of their terrible movies?
It's going to be one of their terrible movies, and I feel very confident in saying that. It is essentially a movie about a translator stuck in a room. It sounds exciting. You remember that Nicole Kidman translator movie? Do you remember how riveting that movie was?
I forgot that was a thing.
Yeah, it wasn't riveting in any way. This has the look of a movie which is trying really hard to create drama in a place where there is, in fact, zero drama. And it really doesn't look like it's going to work. And, you know, that makes me sad for me. I guess, you know, Renner will have to go back to his real estate business and have to come back to the drawing board. But I think this movie looks really, really bad. And that'll be fun for us whenever it finally comes out and we get to see it.
Yeah, we're really good at trashing films that we don't like. So I guess that's something we're good at. No, I want to give it a chance. My wife is like my barometer for what normal people think about movies. And she was like, well, I'm not sold on Jeremy Renner, but I like Amy Adams and Forest Whitaker, so I'll give it a shot, was her opinion on it.
That's a reasonable opinion to have, yes.
That is a very reasonable opinion to have. I had to correct her about Jeremy Renner being awesome, but outside of that, she immediately thinks of the terrible movies that he's done, and rightfully so. Regular people think about those things. My mind immediately goes to The Town, which is one of the best films I've seen in
so
a long time. So, and with that being said, I don't know if normal people like my wife are going to like this film, but I will see it. I'm intrigued. I'm a science nerd by heart, so I think kind of I hate calling it a hard science fiction movie because it's really not, but a science fiction movie that's not lasers and space travel is interesting to me.
Yeah, so like take Interstellar and take all of the interesting space stuff out of it. And it's just the person that's working with the whiteboard inside the room with Michael Caine. That's essentially what this movie looks like.
So it's like The Martian with none of the Mars stuff, is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, exactly. The Martian with a much less interesting Donald Glover writing things on a board.
Well, it's really not hard to be less interesting than Donald Glover.
These are fair statements. So next little bit of news, and it doesn't really seem like a little bit of news. I came with an interview with IGN, Anthony Russo, who he and his brother are directing Infinity War 1 and 2, or whatever the heck they're calling it these days.
Untitled Avengers film.
Infinity War 1 and 2. And he said that Infinity War 1 and 2 are going to be a culmination of everything that has happened in the Marvel Cinematic Universe to this point, and then a relaunch point, for lack of a better terms, for what the MCU will be in the future, which is a very interesting statement. I mean, I want to know how you kind of interpret that.
There are two ways for me to interpret this. One is kind of my sky is falling, everything's going bad, and the other one is more, I guess, of a level-headed, kind of pragmatic approach. And then one is very, like, maybe he's just being cagey about it because that's what Marvel directors do, other than James Gunn, because James Gunn is just awesome and is out there. It seems to me that the easy interpretation is, well, the stories that we've been following through the first three phases are going to be completed. You see Chris Evans' contract is coming to an end. RDJ is a hired gun at this point. You know, he just signs on for one film at a time. And does these little parts. Hemsworth has always seemed like he's kind of one foot in the door, one foot out of the door as far as these things go. So I think the easy interpretation as well, they're relaunching with a lot of young characters. You've got a literal teenager in Spider-Man. They've got Captain Marvel. They've got Doctor Strange. They've got Black Panther. They've got all of these new characters that are really exciting and audience are flocking to. So I think it gives them an easy out, you know, if they don't want to re-sign Evans and Hemsworth and RDJ. I think very literally this is saying everything with the Infinity Stones is wrapping up, because that's been the tale of the first three phases, is the story of the Infinity Stones and the Infinity Gauntlet. So it could just be that. Like, it is the literal culmination of all of the films up until that point. All the Infinity Stone storylines are coming to a head at the Infinity Gauntlet. I think that's probably the most pragmatic in my mind approach, because like it's very literally like these things are wrapping up. So I think it could be a lot of different things. I would hate to see it end, for lack of a better term. Like, it's not going to end because they keep, you know, they can just print their own money. So it's not going to end, but it's a big part of like, kind of the cultural DNA right now of this central team of people in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I mean, it's been since, what, 2005, 2006, since the original Iron Man? What was the original Iron Man?
08, I thought.
08? Yeah. It was
somewhere
around
there.
Yeah, it was late college for me. Late college, early adulting. So, yeah, I think it would be...
I would call that, I'd call that period pre-adulting.
Pre-adulting? I'm still pre-adulting. but I think that would be very sad for me. I love Chris Evans as Captain America. I love RDJ as Iron Man. And if RDJ stops doing these Marvel movies before we get him and Benedict Cumberbatch high-fiving and him calling them beard buddies, I'm going to throw something at someone. If that doesn't happen, this is a travesty.
I think you might need to just watch their episode of the Graham Norton show to find that. Like, that's probably where it's more likely to happen. I think I agree with everything you said. I do think there's an interesting interpretation of this that points to character deaths.
Yep.
Which is something that, aside from Quicksilver, right, we haven't really had to deal with. So that's an interesting kind of. You know, avenue that they can go down and see how the audience reacts to it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if you're fighting the most powerful being in the universe, then it stands to reason there will be some casualties.
Yep.
So I think that's going to be, you know, an interesting one. Yeah, we haven't had to deal with except the entire world being destroyed every summer for the last 10 years. But you know what I'm saying.
And you kind of, you had Coulson a little bit, but then they walked it back with the TV show that is terrible. So I think the character deaths thing seems inevitable. I don't think all of these characters are going to get the peaceful retirement. There are a couple things that I really want to see these characters do before they shuffle the immortal coil or the mortal coil, excuse me. So I really want to see. And one of them will happen in Infinity War is the big speech that Cap gives to Thanos. I have to see that on screen. Chris Evans is going to just crush that. Him basically telling Thanos, yeah, I know we're going to lose, but I'm going to go down swinging. Just kind of embodying everything that Cap is. I hope they don't do the heroic sacrifice thing with Iron Man because they've done it already and it kind of worked. It was okay. They undid all of the characterization there in subsequent movies. So I think, you know, we're missing out on some of that. I think Thor is probably the one that if they kill any of them is going to be the one they go with just because he's been one of the cornerstones of this, but of the three, he's the least liked and his movies gross the least. So the smart move is to off Thor if you're going to off any of the big three. So I'm intrigued to see how that goes.
I really want to see Hawkeye finish that tractor. I'm really rooting for him and his farm.
I mean, Jeremy Renner, let's stay on the farm, bud. This one is well above your pay grade.
Jeremy Renner would rather stay on the farm. These are things I know to be true.
Makes two of us.
So some more Marvel news. We have Deadpool director Tim Miller and 20th Century Fox are reportedly in a fight that you and I had last week, by the way, about who will play Cable in Deadpool Tool, as I named it,
yes,
as I named it last
Tool.
Week. Fox really wants Liam Neeson because apparently he found them. And Miller, but Miller's dead set. I like that. I just came with it. But okay. Miller's dead set on Chandler. So I suppose Kyle Chandler, we talked about last week. I suppose the question is, how do you see this playing out?
I don't know, and it's terrifying. One of the things that was really great about the original Deadpool is that the studio kind of just stayed out of it. And they were just like, you clearly get the characters. You clearly get what's happening. So we're just going to take a back seat and let you chill and do what you do. I think they saw that it was a moneymaker. So now they're going to get involved, which is a little terrifying. We've seen that backfire in many ways in recent history. Star Trek, to name one. Suicide Squad, to name another, our last two big movie podcasts. Both of those films were kind of a hot mess because of studio interference. I don't think they've landed on the guy with either of them. I think as far as, Neeson has more of that gravitas. He has more of that grizzled, grimy, like old weathered guy that you need for kind of the war veteran time traveler Cable. But I still don't think he doesn't do it for me. He's not, I don't see Liam Neeson, and I don't think physically imposing. I think that's something that in my mind Cable needs to have, is kind of being physically imposing. He could go J.K. Simmons and get old man jacked, and we could see that happen. But I still don't think he's got that. Like, say what you want about Aquaman, Ray, but like Jason Momoa is a physically imposing guy. You see him and you're like, oh my gosh, I never want to make him mad. I don't even want to sneeze around him. You see those kinds of guys. You see
Khal
Ron
Drogo
Perlman.
Is scary.
Yeah. You think Ron Perlman, you're like, oh my gosh, that guy will snap his fingers and I will die. So I don't get that with Neeson. Even after, you know, the movie where he fought wolves, was it The Gray? And Taken.
Run All Night? Was that the one?
Yeah. I feel like there was another one.
There was the airline one with Mary Crawley.
Yeah, Taken on a Plane. Yeah, whatever
yeah,
that
take
was.
It on
Red
a plane.
Eye?
What was that
called? No, Red Eye was Cillian Murphy. There's another
Red
one.
Eye. Now, Red Eye is a proper movie with Cillian Murphy and Rachel McAdams.
That's a proper film.
If you have not seen that movie, you should watch that movie.
Don't sleep on Red Eye. Get it. Yeah. Find it on something. Yeah. So I still, long story short, I don't buy him as that physically imposing guy. So again, let them, I'm of the mindset, get out of the way, let the director get who the director wants, and make a good movie. Cause that's what made you money in the first place, was letting the director make a movie that really encapsulated everything the crowd wanted.
I agree with that. The problem is that the director has so clearly missed the mark with the person that they want that, like, at some point, the studio has gotten closer to the bullseye. I agree with you that Liam Neeson's not perfect, but he's closer to the bullseye than Kyle, Bloodlines, Chandler. That's my big takeaway here is you think, okay, we're just going to let the director do his thing, but what if the director is doing their thing wrong, right? What if they got it right the first time, but what if the second time they're Zack Snyder? Like, are you just going to let the director run away with it? Like, I think Chandler's bad. I think it's a wrong decision. And I'm kind of okay with them saying, hey, we need to find someone else because this isn't going to work.
Yeah. I think if they were spot on with it, I would agree with you. But I think because they're still so far off, I'm not on it. And I think Miller knew what he was doing with Deadpool, so why do we doubt him now? Like that's my mindset.
Because he thinks that Kyle Chandler should play Cable. That's why we should doubt him.
I think you got Ed Skrein playing Ajax, and that's not one that I would have called, 50 yards down the line. So I think you give him some room there. He was able to get a decent performance out of an MMA fighter. So when push comes to shove, I want to give the guy some benefit of the doubt. Like he got what he needed out of the people that he wanted. So I give him a little bit of rope on that.
Fair enough. So let's move on to the DC universe, which never gets anything right. And that is that Henry Cavill, not at least since Christian Bale stopped playing Batman, right?
Fear me.
Henry Cavill posted a picture to his Instagram appearing to show a black Superman suit. As we have said on this podcast many times before, I am not an avid comic book reader. So please tell us why this is important.
So the black Superman suit is from the Return of Superman story arc that happened surprisingly after the Death of Superman story arc that was kind of stolen from, really terribly glossed over in BVS. That super pissed me off. It's a very overrated line of comics, but it's also one of the best-selling stories in Superman history. So why do you gloss over it in a 15-minute thing? So when Superman comes back from his, and it gets really weird, it's like a Kryptonian regeneration chamber. He's in an all black suit with like shoulder length curly, like Stallone in Rambo 3 hair, and ooh, two big old machine guns.
I get behind this. I'm behind this 100%.
So super long, like curly jet black hair, black suit, silver Superman crest, gunning out. Yeah. So it's an allusion to that. it could be Henry Cavill messing with fans. Henry Cavill actually has a really good sense of humor. If you've seen some of the things he did at Comic-Con, he was an enormous man dressed up as a comic book character and then got an autograph from Will Smith and pulled off his mask in the middle of it, and everybody had a good laugh about it. So he has a bit of a sense of humor, so it could just be him, like, messing with fans. But I don't think you go into filming of Justice League, fans knowing you're going to have to do some sort of Return of Superman arc. You can't tease that and then not do it. Because the fans already have their pitchforks out and they're already out for blood, so you cannot poke the bear on that. So that's what makes me think it's actually going to happen. Because again, you either you're an idiot or you're following through with it. Like, you're either completely unaware of how this is going to go over if you don't do it, or you're doing it. Like, those are the only two options.
And to be fair, based on what we've seen the last 5 years, the former is completely possible.
It is very possible that they're just that dumb.
it's within the realm. Let's just say that.
Definitely a realm possibility.
Let's move on to things that don't make me sad, and that is two video game, I guess these are remasters, we would call them, of two trilogies which are near and dear to my heart. One of them is near and dear to your heart. The other one, you failed to beat the tutorial of, and that is the Mass Effect trilogy and the Ezio collection, the Ezio trilogy of Assassin's Creed. EA is seriously looking into remastering what I call the greatest video game series of all time, Mass Effect 1, 2, and 3, and I am unbelievably excited about that, and I have to imagine you are as well.
Yeah, they've said for years that they didn't want to remake it, and then and this interview was like, it felt so pandery, it kind of pissed me off almost. Like, well, it's clear that there's a desire for it in the market, so we're seriously considering doing it. Like, come on, like, the of all the games you've remade or made backwards compatible, there may be one other game that has had a higher level of desire for it. That's, you know, Red Dead Redemption. But outside of Red Dead Redemption, I don't know if there's a set of games that people have wanted backwards compatible or remastered more than Mass Effect. I think, you know, Mass Effect 1 is already backwards compatible. It was in that first wave of backwards compatible games. But I think it truly is in need of, like, a remake and a remaster and an update. Because as much as I love that game, Mass Effect 1 is probably one of my all-time favorite games. It plays like it's a 10-year-old game. It does. And so I would love to see them update it to a new engine. You know, the textures still kind of pop in and out at times. So I would love to see this in a full 1080 up-res, like, beautiful campaign. It's one of my favorite stories in a game ever. You know, it's got such an amazing mix of, like, you know, detective noir elements, trying to figure out what's going on behind the scenes. It's got the massive space opera thing happening. It's got the very personal story. It's got one of the toughest moments I've ever faced in a video game. Spoiler alert for a 10-year-old game. The Kaiden Ashley decision, like, I sat there before it for probably 3 to 5 minutes before I made the decision. And then I sat there for 3 to 5 minutes after I made the decision and just washed in the consequences of this, because the whole time I was like, this is the only time it's ever happened to me in a video game where I made the decision. I was like, oh, there's going to be a way out of this. Oh, there's going to be a way out of this. Oh, there's going to be a way out of it. Kaiden just blew up. Holy crap. No going back. So I would look.
That's the first, I know it probably wasn't the first game, but that's the first game that I remember really getting into that decision I made in the first game. Like, affects you literally the rest of the way. The ending you end up with in Mass Effect 3 is at least in some ways affected by the decision you made between Ashley and Kaiden. Like,
yeah,
that's insanity to think about that breadth of storytelling in a video game.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's one of the, you know, you can argue about whether or not they delivered on the promise of your decisions making an impact. But that is one of the things that, like, legitimately, like, 60 to 90 hours later, depending on how deep you played the other two games, that decision had an impact on how that game turned out. And again, like, going through all of the emotion, like, I would say probably 90% of the emotional moments I've had playing video games are in the Mass Effect series. The other 10% are split between BioShock and Dragon Age. But the scene where, you know, Morden is going to make up for his past sins, like, I could just rattle things off. The decision between you know, Tally's people and the Geth, like that decision. Like, it's just, there's so much like, people need to play these games. Like, that, I hesitate to make a broad statement like that, but if there's a series of games that people need to play to understand what games can do and how even artistic games can be, it's, in my mind, it's the Mass Effect trilogy.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. And you said that it's in backwards compatibility, Mass Effect 1, but it's just not the same. Like, right now, I'm actually, it's funny that they mentioned the Ezio Collection. Right now I'm playing back through Assassin's Creed 2 in backwards compatibility, and it's just, it's not the same. It feels like an old game. It's clunky, the movement's weird, the fighting animations are weird, the movement's weird. It's just, it feels like an old game. And so getting that remaster would be huge. It would give you another opportunity to you know, get past the most embarrassing video game moment of your life, which I think is an important thing for you.
It would allow me to redeem myself as a man, really, and get some get some of my man cards back, being able to master that. And really, like, and this sounds dumb, but like, it's one of those big, like, missing points on my, like, gaming resume. Like, it's one of the best games of that generation, the Assassin's Creed 2, and then, you know, the other two that followed it. So I really do want to play through that again. I love Black Flag. Black Flag was a great game. Unity was a steaming pile, but that was really more technical issues over storytelling or whatever. I think it's wise that they went away from the annualized installations. But yeah, if you're talking about games from the previous era of consoles, the previous generations, I think BioShock, which they've already announced, we get those three. And I think Mass Effect and Assassin's Creed 2 are the ones that I want people to play.
I could also deal with God of War 2 and Red Faction 2. Love those two games. From PS2, those two games. Unbelievable. All right. Now that we're in our nostalgia mode,
yes,
let's move on to the most nostalgic show. I'm not even going to call it a television show. We got to move past that. We got to find another word for this. The most nostalgic series.
Episodic narration.
Episodic narration.
That's too wordy.
Certainly of this year. It's from Netflix. It's called Stranger Things. It's, you know, become huge. I think you and I even watched it later than other people. I still think that people are finding it, though. I imagine people will continue to find it for, you know, for a long time. And it's, I think that my initial reaction, and I'll get to you, is just that I loved it. I mean, I burned through it so quickly. I thought the decision to do 8 episodes, which is the same thing, by the way, The Night Of on HBO is doing, I thought it was a great idea. You didn't get as bogged down in even the 12 episode, you know, series that we see now. I burned through all 8 in, I think it was like 2 days. It didn't have really any low points for me. I can't think of a low point. So I absolutely loved this show. And I think that maybe you agree with that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And there are a lot of people that are still finding the show. I hate to say something like this, but I think people that aren't as ingrained in genre film or genre TV haven't caught this yet, simply because, like, I've got coworkers that are normal people, to use a term, and I'm still having to convince them to watch it. But then I've got a buddy, like a couple friend of my wife and I, who, like, he and his wife burned through it in like 2 days. Like, they just, like, that's what we did this weekend. We popped some popcorn and watched all 8 episodes of Stranger Things. So, like, I think there are people that aren't necessarily, that don't live and breathe the genre entertainment that haven't seen it yet. But no, I think you're absolutely right. It was one of the best episodics that I have seen in a long time. And that is including all of the Netflix Marvel stuff. That's including, it would right now, and again, it's only one season, but of my, like, top seasons of television, it's up there. Like, it's up there with season 4 of The Wire, And season six of Scrubs, you know, the some of my favorites of all time. Like, it's up there with that. And it doesn't hurt that it was kind of made for me. Like, everything that I love is in this show. So it doesn't hurt that it was made for me. But I think the casting is perfect. I think it's you get very uneven performances from child actors usually. And all these actors are really, really good. To make a long story short, like, I loved it. I adored it. My wife, who gets super anxious watching a lot of very dramatic, very tense things, she was actually the one that kept us on pace to get it watched for tonight's episode. She was like, hey, let's watch another episode tonight. Hey, we need to watch another episode tonight. She was eating it up, and she's not really into anything scary. Like, she changes the channel when a trailer for a scary movie comes on. We like have to balance out. Okay, we can watch one episode of Justified, and we need to watch two episodes of I almost called it Reno 911, Brooklyn 99 to balance it out.
Like, I support that, Reno 911 too.
Reno 911 is fantastic, but it's really not her cup of tea. But no, and she was into it. So like that to me, like, again, I use my wife as kind of the barometer for what like normal people are into, and she loved it.
And I think that brings up a good point. And first of all, I should say on the top here, spoiler alerts, right?
All over.
So we're gonna talk about some plot points. I think you have to in this show. So I give you 3 seconds until I get into my first spoiler here.
We should. What's the timestamp for Don't Sleep? We're at about an hour.
Yeah, something like that. So yeah. So we'll get into it later. But actually, just go watch all 8 episodes today, and then come back.
Come back.
Yeah.
Watch this next week.
Exactly. It's because it's worth doing that. But I think that to your point about why your wife liked it is because, and you said she doesn't like, you know, scary, frightening stuff. My wife didn't watch it. She's exactly like that. She jumps in children's movies, which is like she jumped violently at one point in the Lego movie, which made me laugh uncontrollably. And so like she is.
Mommy, why is the big man laughing?
She is super not into thrillers. It's just not her thing. And so she didn't watch it. But even though if she would watch it, she would have liked it. I think that one of the reasons why it has that broad appeal, even broader than horror movies, which do have pretty broad appeal, they always make more money than people expect they will, is because they didn't focus as much on the monster, which seems to be built up as the antagonist of the show, right? But they didn't focus as much on the monster as they did on the relationships of these various groups of people. And so that was impressive that they focused on the relationships. It was even more impressive that they were able to juggle all of these disparate groups of people. And that was really something that was impressive in this show and showed a level of storytelling and filmmaking that you don't see very often, in which you're able to juggle not even like an A, B, and C story arc, because that happens in every random show that exists, but equally important and intertwined story arcs that come together at the end. And I think that what they were able to do with the relationship between the kids, between, you know, Will and the three boys, and then the three boys and Eleven, and then the relationship they had with Winona Ryder's character and John, and then her husband and Hopper, and then the relationship with Nancy and Steve and John. Like, you just go through these lists, the relationship with Nancy and her mother, which her mother, that character. We'll talk about that character later. But But there's so much, like, the way that they're able to do this, and you're just interested in the whole thing. And when the show closes, when the show ends, obviously there's a climactic fight scene and everything like that, but that's not really the end of the show.
No.
The end of the show is these people and how they've grown together, or I suppose apart in some instances, but mostly together throughout the course of these events that are basically just a backdrop for these characters' growth. And that's such a perfect way to tell a story. And I think it's one of the things that, by the way, it's one of the things I think a show that I'm watching, I know you don't watch Mr. Robot, is doing excellently this season, but is catching a lot of stick for it because that's not kind of what it was season one. Now it's what it's turned into season two, which is a great show in my opinion, but people don't tend to like that. So the fact that Stranger Things is able to come in here and do this thing that people maybe don't tend to like and people love it, I think shows maybe just how well they were able to do it.
Yeah, and I think it reminds me of two of the most lauded TV shows of the last 15 years, or really three of them, really, if you think about it, and they're all on HBO, but The Sopranos, The Wire, and Game of Thrones. There's a reason why in all of those series that the second-to-last episode of every season was the action-packed one, and the last episode of every season is a slower episode, because it's not the action that people are tuning into a good TV show for. It's the characters, and it's the relationships, and it's where do these events leave our characters. And so that to me was the most powerful piece of the storytelling in this TV show was that 2 months later piece where, you know, they were the Will's family was at dinner, and, you know, the sister and her boyfriend Steve are watching a movie. Like it's you know, those are the things that drove you there. Again, I think the like you said, the characters, the moments that they had, they got you invested. Like spoiler alert, when you found out Barb's fate, like my wife was visibly disturbed when you found out. She's no, like that was, or like when again, huge spoiler alert, when they found Will's body in the ravine, you had 15 minutes of screen time with that kid at most on the heavy end. And that was like devastating emotionally. They got you so invested in these characters, and that's what kept you coming back. The monster was honestly kind of cheesy. Like it reminded me of Signs a lot. That's what immediately came to my mind was Signs. But it wasn't about that. It was those little subtle moments, those moments of growth. Hopper's flashbacks, my gosh, talk about heartbreaking.
I hadn't even thought about this. I can't, the fact you said it just brought it back. Him in the hospital room is,
yeah.
Oh my goodness. Like that was a stunning piece of television. Like it just, yes. It was unbelievable. It was done so well. It drew out the, like, so what I think is interesting is that difference between maybe a good filmmaker and a great one is a good filmmaker knows the emotion they're trying to get from you, and they do a pretty good job getting it. A great one knows exactly how to get that emotion out of you, and it seemed like this show was really good at that. And that scene in the hospital room, it's just, and where it was placed in the show, just as a level of storytelling that I don't want to say too much about it, because it seems like we're heaping praise on a show that's only done eight episodes. These guys have only really ever done 8 episodes in their lives. Like this could very well be their Juno. Like they could be Diablo Cody, right? This could very well be just the only thing they ever do well. But this, if that's the case, they can hold their head high, because this was very, very well done.
Well, and I think it's okay to lump praise on something that's deserving. There's a reason why Orson Welles ate himself to death. Like that was the culmination of all the things. And you know, Citizen Kane, rightfully so, is a masterpiece of filmmaking. You know, debate whether or not it's good, but it's influential and it's important. But no, I think it's you know, that's the great thing about these Netflix shows, is that they give these young, hungry filmmakers an opportunity to kind of flex their muscles a little bit. Like, hey, we like your vision. We like what you have going on. Give it a shot. These guys did 4 episodes of Wayward Pines, like, before this, which I had never watched. I'm now wanting to, like, go back and check it out, maybe. You know, it's Raymond saying no.
I was only vaguely aware that was a television show, and only because the commercials come on during Gotham.
Well, you've got Carla Gugino, your favorite person.
My girl Carla's in it?
Yes.
All right, I'll watch it tonight.
Okay, cool. I knew that'd get you in.
The only reason I saw San Andreas.
You also need stuff to do on Sunday afternoons, right?
Yeah.
But no, and I think the other thing is that the thing that really spoke to me, one of the things that immediately drew me in, is you can do a period piece and it feels forced, and you can do a period piece that feels natural, and this felt natural. Like this felt like The Duffer Brothers love the 80s in a non-ironic way. Like, there are people that love the 80s ironically. There are people that love the 90s ironically. But they love the 80s. They love Indiana Jones. They love E.T. They love Firestarter. They love Stand By Me. They love it. Like, they love those things. Like, that is part of who they are. And it's so, like, beautifully encapsulated being a kid in those times. I thought, like, there was no other... I knew instantly that this was made for me when it opens up with four little kids having the time of their lives playing D&D in their basement. Like, I was like, this is for me. I literally paused and looked at my wife and said, this is already my favorite TV show. Like, it was just, it was amazing. It completely encapsulated what it means to be a kid and that sense of awe and that sense of wonder and not knowing what's out there. And this almost felt like it would have totally been like Will Byers' fever dream. Like, he's... like, it would have been totally something that a kid in the 80s would have invented. You know, the men in suits and government agencies and conspiracies. Like, it totally feels like the backyard playings of a kid of the 80s.
Yeah, it was like this weird amalgamation of like you mentioned all of them, like E.T. and like it with like a little War Games thrown in there.
Yep.
And like it was just this weird, like, And you and I aren't even that old. We weren't kids of the 80s. We're definitely 90s kids.
Yeah,
but I think we have an appreciation for you know, John Carpenter and people like that. And so mm-hmm. I think that it really shone through. So I think I've said this before, but there's a difference between an homage and karaoke.
Yep.
And so often people that try to make homages end up doing karaoke, and it's very pokey. Really,
and not that weird.
That's good.
It was good,
but this was not that. This was very much an homage, and it was very well done. And I have to say, like you mentioned, some of the casting. How about Winona Ryder, who should just play every frantic person in every movie from now on? Like, her playing a frantic person is perfect. She did that. She did that beautifully. And then I have to say that I think that I both liked and didn't like the ending,
mm-hmm.
The after effect of the ending, because one, it was setting up stuff for the next season, which they have to do. That's just television, fine and dandy. You don't have to do that. You could talk to the people at American Horror Story about it, but that's doesn't seem to be where they're going, and so obviously they had to set some up. But I also kind of liked the ending because it wasn't the storybook ending, right? Stuff's still wrong.
Yeah.
Right? Nancy's still with Steve, who may or may not be a good guy, right?
I don't know.
I can't tell either. John,
I don't know.
John Ralphio's
Steve.
Dad is really hard to pin down. So
yes.
I don't know. So I don't know what to think about him. Obviously Will. I mean,
coughing up devil slugs.
He might want to go to the doctor.
Yeah,
like I think that people abuse the emergency room, but I'm going to put that on a list. Like, check, yes, you can see the doctor if you are coughing up intergalactic slugs. I'm pretty sure that qualifies. Like, your HMO probably covers that, I would assume.
Probably, yeah.
So like he's got to go. I mean, obviously, Hopper is still. Like, something's going on with him. He gets into a car, and now he just knows where a box in the forest where he can give Eggos to, who could that be? We'll talk about it in a bit. But, like, there's stuff going on there. And so I like that it wasn't, on the surface, it kind of looked like a storybook ending, but it wasn't. And I think that leaves them some interesting places to take it season two. But before we go there, we've been gushing about this show. There has to be some things you didn't like.
Some of the things I didn't like, I think the thing that I didn't like the most, was just a lot of the, some of it felt a lot of just like runny yelly, for lack of a better term. It's just, there was a lot of, terror for the sake of terror. Again, I said it already. I thought the monster wasn't what it was about, but I thought the monster was probably the least impressive piece of it, especially given how cool the portals into the Upside Down looked. And then the monster was super disappointing. I thought Matthew Modine was a little one note at times. I thought He was very menacing, but that was all he did. And if that's how he goes out, then I would be super annoyed that if it was just like an off-screen death.
But that's not how he goes out.
It's not how he goes out. No, he'll be back for sure. But I think that the monster was probably my lowest point. They maybe leaned a little too much into Stand By Me with some of the bully stuff. Like, don't get me wrong, I love Stand By Me, and like the walking down the train tracks was really cool, and the, you know, giving the bully his comeuppance was really cool.
Yeah, but those bullies, like, that got real.
Yeah.
Like, that got real, real, and it kind of took me out of it. I kind of went, because I'm from a small town, right? We had bullies. Yeah. Like, people don't pull knives on people like that.
No.
Like, that was too far.
Yeah. You know, very few bullying, and you know what, maybe bullying is gotten a little bigger than it used to be when we were young, but not many 12-year-olds are going to make somebody jump off a cliff.
Yeah. I'm going to go ahead and say that even at my meanest, I was not going to make someone jump to their death. That's not bullying. That's like sadism at that point, right?
Sociopathy at its finest.
So that, yeah, I'm with you. The bully stuff was over the top for sure.
Yeah. But outside of that, I mean, that for me was, were really the low points. I think the monster, and the bullying stuff was just a bit too much. But outside of that, I really don't think it was, I thought the sense of humor in this show was really good. What were your low points, right? Other than the bullying?
Two things.
Okay.
One, Miss Wheeler.
Okay.
Terrible. Like, just all.
Okay. Yeah.
So this bothers me all the time, but if you want your kids to talk to you, perhaps you shouldn't menacingly yell at them that they can talk to you. Like, just a parenting tip. Like, if you want your kids to actually open up and say things to you, you can't yell at them to say things to you. And she did it, like, 90% of her lines were yelling at her kids to talk to her.
I want you to know you can tell me anything.
But I am going to yell at you about whatever you tell me. Like,
this is not a safe place to express yourself, but I want it to be.
I just, that character just annoyed me so much. And then I know everybody's talked about it. I know everybody talks about this all the time, but it bears repeating because it is absolutely terrible. Why aren't you helping Barb? Barb is laying behind. They just found out that they could revive Will, and not one of them thinks, oh, Barb's back there. Maybe I'll go back and see if we can't revive her. You know, she's probably dead, but give it a go, right? See if you can't work your hopper magic on her. And where are her parents? Barb's parents, like, you see her once. You see him once. They're sitting in the couch in the Wheeler's house, just like once for like 3 minutes. And they're wearing black and they look slightly perturbed, like their newspaper wasn't delivered on time on Sunday morning. Like they are completely disconnected from what's happening. Nobody seems to care that a teenage girl is missing. Like, they got out an entire search party. Literally the entire town got out and went and looked for this little boy. And then Barb disappears. They're like, yeah, I mean, stuff happens. Like, I don't know what you want us to do. Like, it was unbelievable. It was such a bad, like, they handled it so, so poorly. And I don't understand why. It was just confusing.
Yeah, I think, you know, the Duffers have addressed that a little bit. You know, the span of the show is only supposed to take place over about a week. And so, you know, you've seen it happen before where one tragedy happens and then another tragedy happens immediately following. And the second one gets glossed over, or the first one gets glossed over. One of them gets glossed over. That happened in Oklahoma a couple of years back where there were two equally devastating tornadoes. And one of them got a lot more press. And the other one, the people that were hit by it were living in tents for a month and a half. So, like, it happens a lot of times where there's only so much attention people can pay to tragedies, or they'll only kind of pick and choose one. And I think that's kind of hand waving it away. I thought it's just lazy filmmaking, not lazy filmmaking, but it's bad filmmaking, granted, for something that we love so much. But, you know, you always pick on the ones you love the most. That's why I have to be careful around my wife and people that I enjoy. But yeah, no, I think it's like even just, we know she's dead. Let's grab her body so her parents have something to bury.
Yeah. No, like they like leave her back there. Like, nah, it's fine.
Yep. She's, we know we're never going to be able to come back to this place. She's part of the upside down now. Yeah. She's just part of it. What if Barb is the monster in season two?
Ooh. The reanimated corpse of Barb comes climbing out of Steve's pool and messes up his hair. And that's how season two starts.
I'd be okay with it. Barb's Stranger Things 2, Barb's Revenge. Very 80s. Very, very 80s.
So speaking of season two, I guess we should get into kind of what we're looking for season two. Luckily, there was an interview done today with the brothers in which they talked about a lot of stuff. But I just kind of want to think about, you know, what are your questions you have and where do we go from here?
I think for me, like initially, you know, when it was over, my wife and I actually had a conversation with her, and I told her that I really wanted it to be an anthology series. Like, I really thought this would have worked really well as like what American Horror Story is doing, or True Detective tried to do, where it tells a new story every, and even like the name fits that. Like Stranger Things feels like an anthology series, and it would be a very 80s thing to do. That's not going to be what happens. But I think now that we know, this may be my hot take of the day. I don't want them to bring back 11. I do not want them to bring back 11. I think bringing back 11, at least in an identical role or something as the same character, is a mistake. It negates all of the emotional catharsis of what she does in the classroom. I think having her come back as the same character, oh, it's me again. It would feel too much like Beer Fest when what's his name? Landfill 2
shows up. When his brother comes back. I really appreciate it. You know, I know this might be weird, but I really appreciate it if you guys would just call me Landfill.
Yeah. Like that's what it would feel like to me. Like, oh, let's not talk about anything that happened.
Super obscure reference that I immediately got because we're best friends.
But it makes sense, right? It makes sense. Yeah, this is how many
people got that one?
You know,
how many Broken Lizard fans are there out there?
At least six, four of which are not represented on this podcast. Two of them are our other two best friends. No, that's what it would feel like to me, though. It feel like it would negate everything that happened in the classroom at the end of the show. Like Elle's heroic sacrifice, if she can just magically come back, is no longer heroic sacrifice, and it's just another cool thing she can do with her superpowers. The all of that emotion is just negated. I would really love, because like I said, they said that it takes place over a span of like 6 or 7 days. So I would love to see, the like emotional fallout of this. Like, you don't just have a kid missing for a week and another person go missing and the town just continue on as if nothing happened.
Well, that's kind of what they said, was they said that that's what they want to do, is they want to examine the fallout. The problem they have is that the kids are growing up. I mean, kids that age just change so quickly. They even said that they wanted to go back with Mike and do some after recording to you know, redub some things to make it cleaner sound, and they couldn't because his voice had already dropped. And so you're in a weird situation with kids that at that age, which is difficult. Yeah. And so they've already said they're going to have to jump forward. They're going to have to do, I believe the quote was, they're going to have to do it the Harry Potter way. And so they're going to have to jump forward at least a year, maybe two, which opens up some interesting possibilities, I think, to your point. It's not just we're starting on New Year's Day, right? Because we saw the end, we saw Christmas. It's not we're starting a week later on New Year's Day and we're trying to work through this. We're starting a year later. And whatever's happening to Will has taken its course, and maybe it creates... some situation that drifts the family apart or tears the town apart. You know, we know finally what happened to Barb, and maybe that creates some feelings. You know, whatever Hopper's doing with, I guess, presumably 11 in the, and that's what we're led to believe, at least with the box in the woods, whatever he's doing with 11. And I would guess Hawkins at this point, whatever he's doing with that, like maybe he's left now. And you know, with Nota Ryder, maybe she's gone crazy because of what's going on to Will. So there's a way in a year to see this world in a much different way. And then to have an event that brings these people back together after some estrangement. Essentially the final season of Parks and Rec, or at least the first half of the final season of Parks and Rec, which was really good and really interesting. Obviously, it's a very different animal, but I'm just saying, like, that idea that something's estranged and it's bringing it back together. And I think that would work. It wouldn't be an anthology series. I can't say that word.
Anthology.
What's anthropology?
Where'd you get that?
Isn't that really like hipster store in malls? No, it's anthropology.
Anthropology.
Which is spelled not like anthropology, which I've yet to figure out why.
Anthropology.
It's so weird. Anyway, but I think that it's not quite that. It's not quite an anthology series, but it is almost a different world that you're coming back into, which is an interesting idea.
Yeah, and I think I always have loved the kind of like almost like the Watchmen, where like they've all gone their separate ways. They're living their own lives, and then you know maybe Hop dies or something brings them all back together, and they discover that there's something deeper going on. There's something more to it. They unravel more, because that would feel very X-Files, which is something that this show felt. You know, when people ask me what it's like, I describe it as the Goonies and the X-Files had a baby. And that would feel very X-Files if you've got some mystery in the Men in Black and all of that. I think there, for me, again, I think it's going to all fall back on what do they do with the characters? I mean, they can't just do, you know, Will in the bathroom coughing up space slugs and not do anything with it. They're very specifically doing that for a reason. Like there absolutely is a reason why they do that, because they want to explore that more. But what does that mean? You know, is Will evil? Is Will, like, you know, and really, not to get too meta on it, but it's also a statement on like the adventures you have as a child that you'll always carry them with you. So I think that if they never do anything again, like that's the lasting impact of that. But again, I was hoping for an anthology series. I think at some point they're going to have to either move on, because you're going to lose that magic. That's really what I'm afraid of. There's a very particular magic about this show, and it's hard to capture lightning in a bottle twice. And that's really what they did with this. They definitely captured lightning in a bottle, and it's going to be nigh impossible to do it again. So I think you have to go with a completely different feel. I don't want to say completely different feel, but a very different feel, a very different you know, focus, a very different... You can't carry the mystery thing for 10 seasons. Lost proved that, that you can't make a mystery last for 10 seasons. So I think they're going to have to go in a different direction and maybe make it very character-driven, maybe make it very, you know, character-focused, character-study to give us something different but still the same.
And I think that's why diving in on Hopper might be the play, because there's still mystery there, right? In fact, David Arbor said in a Reddit AMA that they asked, you know, do you think your daughter died of cancer or something to that effect? And he said that was a mystery they're going to kind of look into in season two, which is an interesting idea, because there's a lot of backstory there. The way his daughter died, you know, what he was doing with those men after, you know, after it came back, why he knows where Eleven's box is. Like there's some interesting stuff going on there. And so maybe he becomes the POV character in season two, which does change it a little bit, and which opens up, you know, a little bit. And then just one, like, I hope that John realizes how creepy he is. That's something I hope. I hope that Nancy eats a sandwich.
Yes.
Because she needs many of them. And then I hope
at least three.
And then I hope that she leaves Steve and John and Nancy can get together. Aww.
See, I don't even. I'm not a John/Nancy. I'm a Nancy. Just do you, girl. Nancy, be strong and independent.
Yeah.
Just
put
just,
on a Beyonce song and just move.
Who run that world? Nancy. Let's do it.
That would be a fun kind of. Why is Beyonce playing in the background in 1984?
Beyonce is 6 months old at this current juncture.
So I think I'm going to use this as my don't sleep because we're running a little long. I think I'll use this as my don't sleep. So we're going to talk about something in a minute that's going to be about Stranger Things. In fact, let's just move right into it. My favorite segment every week, don't sleep. I have one that I've been sitting on now for 2 weeks. I apologize. We'll talk about it. I'll talk about it next week. But the,
hopefully.
Maybe. But this is
this going to be your Matt Damon? Get off my show, Matt Damon.
Get off my show, Matt. But I think that this is so interesting. It's a tinfoil theory. It's been floating around for a very, like for a couple weeks now. I heard it a while ago. But then UpRocks, I believe, and I'll put this in the show notes, did a nice kind of two minute and 30 second video kind of overviewing it. But the basic idea is that Eleven is the monster. That Eleven and the monster are one and the same. The monster is the physical representation of the other side of Eleven's personality, of the fear and the anger that she felt as a test subject at Hawkins, that she was able to bring this kind of physical manifestation to life with her telekinetic powers. And there's some interesting points to this. The first, I guess, the most interesting thing is that she does not encounter the monster in the Upside Down. She's not in the Upside Down when she first encounters the monster. She is in her isolation chamber. She is in the black nothingness of her isolation chamber. So theoretically, there's nothing in there except her. And then this monster shows up, which kind of suggests she created herself. Now, if that was it, then I wouldn't think much of it. But there's some interesting nuggets that kind of point us to this idea. And it starts in that first scene you were talking about in Dungeons & Dragons. What the monster they're fighting, right, which they end up calling this monster, Eleven's monster, is a Demogorgon, which in Dungeons & Dragons is a character with a split personality between its two heads, which is ultimately both trying to dominate and kill each other. So you have this idea of duality in that first scene that we have. Then, and they end up calling the monster that. The monster doesn't have two heads, we don't think, but they end up calling it that, which is a really interesting idea. And then later in that same episode, they're riding home. Will ends up beating, I blanked on his name, but he ends up beating his friend in the race, right? Mm-hmm. And what edition, what comic book does he ask for? We asked for X-Men 134, which X-Men 134, famous comic, just happens to be where Dark Phoenix is introduced. And Dark Phoenix, how does Dark Phoenix come about? Well, Mastermind is fiddling around in Jean Grey's brain and releases Dark Phoenix, which sounds awfully familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And so that's a really interesting point. Third, it comes in the final episode, the battle episode, where she's going after the monster. First, when Eleven lifts her arm, the monster does the exact same thing. It mirrors her completely whenever she does that, which is an interesting thing that I don't think I would have noticed when I was first watching it, but I went back and watched it, and that's true. And then the second thing is that the only way that she can kill this monster is to kill herself in the process, or at least disintegrate herself with the monster in the process. And then fourth, and this is the most important thing, she says it, and you kind of go past it because it's kind of in the middle of the show, middle of the series, but at some point she says she is the monster. She says, I am the monster. She says it. So I think that this theory is very, very interesting. And I think that it's one that is true. And I go back to Mr. Robot because I've been watching all of these shows at the same time. And Mr. Robot had a very similar theory that came out after episode one that just was proven true in last week's episode. And I think that this could be another one of those. This could be another one of those, you know, R plus L equals J, those theories that people just hit. And it'll be interesting to see where this goes. So what do you think about it?
Yeah, I'm really intrigued by it. I'm going to have to watch this video now. You put it in the show notes as a late addition. I've been running and gunning all afternoon, so I'll have to watch it, and I'll make my wife watch it with me because she's sitting in the bed. We'll just throw it up on the old Chromecast. No, I think it's really interesting, and I think, you know, this doesn't seem like a show that does things by accident, and so it seems like all those things are there very intentionally.
X-Men 134, that,
yeah.
of all the books that you could pick,
yeah,
that's a big tell, I think.
Yeah, I think, and I think even, you know, the Demogorgon, it's one of those things that it reminds me of, like, The Prestige, where they're putting it out in front of you and just begging you to guess it. And so, yeah, I mean, it's like the first monster of the series is the Demogorgon. So like that, I'm interested to see it.
Also, don't sleep on the Prestige.
Don't sleep on the Prestige. No. Ever. So yeah, I think it's spot on. I'm excited to watch this video. I'm glad it's only a couple of minutes and not like your normal 25 minute YouTube theory video that you see. Here are five reasons why.
Hold on. You can say that I send you. That's fine.
No, it's not just you. My YouTube recommendations are real weird at this point. I've watched a lot of random like Game of Thrones and other TV show theories.
Have you heard about the Denver Airport, bro?
Oh my gosh, Harambe was an inside job. Okay, so moving on from dank memes, my don't sleep for the week is it's Amazon pilot season, and Amazon pilot season will often bring something that I will enjoy and then never see another episode of. And so this year, something I'll enjoy and never see another episode of is a new version of The Tick. And for those of you that are unfamiliar with The Tick originally it was a comic series, and then it was an animated show that Raymond and I grew up with in the early to mid 90s, and then there was an early 2000s live action with Patrick Warburton as The Tick, and the guy from Lost / the mayor from the Dark Knight movies as Batman Well. And so this incarnation stars Peter Serafinowicz, who most Americans will know as the guy from Guardians of the Galaxy who drops the "what a bunch of a-holes" line. But he's a very famous British comedian. So the concept of it is really simple. The Tick is a Superman type, you know, invulnerable, super strength, can't fly, but he's an idiot. He's just straight up just adult, like no way to describe him other than just an idiot. And so he gets paired with, depending on the incarnation that you're seeing, anywhere from mild-mannered accountant to borderline suicidal, split personalities, voices in my head accountant named Arthur, who reluctantly becomes his sidekick. And so this incarnation does a really interesting thing of, it honestly feels like a lot like Daredevil, where it feels very raw and gritty. And then you have Peter Serafinowicz spouting off all of these really, really idiotic things. And it kind of works. It's, you don't often see your slapstick and your straight man as the same character, but the delivery of that Peter Serafinowicz has serves that purpose, where he's saying these really ridiculous things, but he's completely earnest about it. Or he's talking about, there's a line in there that he talks about, destiny has chosen us both, and are you going to answer it? It feels warm in here, like the inside of a loaf of bread. And then he just does this like weird body wiggle as Arthur tries to retort. It's just hilarious. Like, it's just so outlandish while trying to like have this serious face. It's like, it feels like Leslie Nielsen is what it feels like. And so I would say don't sleep on it. If you like it, go to Amazon and vote for it so we can get some more of it. So yeah, don't sleep on the new version of The Tick.
You got me thinking with Amazon. When is the second season of The Man in the High Castle coming out?
I don't know.
Oh, I found it.
I don't know.
December 16th. Yeah.
Okay.
That show, another don't sleep. We got like seven don't sleeps in here.
Just getting them for free.
That The Man in the High Castle, that was a proper series right there.
I love me some alternate realities, yeah. Alternate histories.
That one's fun. That one's a good time. So that about does it for us. We hope you liked the episode. We hope you liked the show. If you do, please go to iTunes, to Stitcher, to TuneIn, to wherever you find us. Rate and review the show. It helps others find the show. And we really appreciate you listening. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at RM Summerlin. You can follow him on Twitter. He's at GH Goodridge for now.
And maybe GU Goodridge moving forward.
It likely will be, depending on how quickly I can draw up this paperwork. And until next time, stay woke.
Stay woke.